Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
So Christmas time is here again, Josh.
Not quite, but we're getting there.
We're getting there. I mean, it's the season.
Okay, it's Christmas time.
It's Christmas time. It's not Christmas, but it's Christmas time. And I'll tell you something. It may be a little bit too late by now with the free shipping at AdamandEve.com to get somebody else a gift. But what if you got some Christmas money and you want to get yourself a gift and help out me and Josh?
Well, what you would do is you'd go to AdamandEve.com. Do you know what you do when you got there?
Yes, you do shopping. You pick out the dildo, the lingerie, the men's toys, the women's toys,
DVDs,
the whatever you want. And you find at the very, very end it says coupon code or promo code or something like that. I don't remember.
Static.
What?
Static.
What?
Static.
Oh.
The promo code static.
S-T-A-T-I-C?
Sure. And then you get 50% off of a single item.
Okay.
You get free shipping.
Okay.
You get three, not one, not two, three free DVDs.
Three.
And a free mystery gift that's so mysterious, they can't even tell you about it. It's going to be a big... It's like on Christmas morning. You don't know what's in the wrapping.
That you get a little bit of Christmas after Christmas.
Exactly.
You can. It'll tide you over till the next holiday. What is the next holiday?
New Year's. Well, a week away.
I don't know. Well, from New Year's, I kind of lump that in with Christmas. That's like one big holiday week because the kids.
Because you're drunk the entire time.
Drunk most of the time. Yes. I have a weakness for eggnog.
Eggnog with vodka added, huh?
But anyway, rum. But anyway, go to AdamandEve.com. When you check out, use that promo code of static. You'll be getting Josh and I a little bit of a gift because we got a little bit from that. And you'll be getting all those great deals, your three DVDs, your free shipping, your mystery gift.
And 50% off a single item.
And that goes, I do have to clarify, that goes for most items at AdamandEve.com. There are a few that you can't get that deal with, but that's okay.
But it's like 99% of the stuff.
Yeah, 99% of the stuff on that site. So, huzzah.
He just gave me a thumbs up. You do know this is audio, right? They can't see the thumbs up.
Everybody knows what a thumbs up sounds like.
I'm sure they do. All right, now that we got that out of the way and we blew 3 minutes of this show away, tonight's topic. Topics. We have a kind of a backup topic if we don't go the whole time on this first one. But you were telling me before the show that your wife used to be a Harry Potter fan.
Huge Harry Potter fan.
Of the books.
A huge fan of the books. Big fan of the movies. When the first few that came out, she was a big Harry Potter fan. I mean, I remember when I first moved up to Green Bay in 2004, I remember going out, and I forget which movie it was at that time, but me and her and a bunch of our friends dressed up and went to the midnight showing and had a good time. And it was one of those things that really spoke to her, was the Harry Potter fandom. Not so much anymore.
Well, is it because of what the movies themselves became?
No.
Or because of what the idiots going to the movies became?
Well, it was what the idiots going to the movies became. It was the stuff that she found online, you know,
the Rule 34 stuff.
Yeah, fanfic of, you know, if there is not porn of it, there will be, there is now, and you know there is porn of it, period. But anyway, yeah, that the slash fiction, you're seeing a lot of the same reactions, and it wasn't even so much all of the actual writing that bothered her, because you get that with anything.
unfortunately.
You name anything, there's going to be a fan fiction repository, and there's always going to be...
I've never understood the whole fan fiction subgenre.
Me either, but there's always going to be a subgenre of fan fiction that is either going to be the Rule 34 stuff, where male and females get together, and then you've got the slash fiction, which is pretty much gay and all of that, and it's going to happen, and you just deal with it.
Oh, they've had that. Do you remember when we were growing up? There was all the Spock, Stups, Kirk stuff.
Oh yeah,
you know, I mean, that's been going around since classic Trek days.
Oh yeah, sure, and
before that,
but it was more the people that started going to the theater that. The people that got out into public that ruined it for, and you're seeing a lot of the same people with Twilight now.
Except the Twilight people. Now, I don't like Harry Potter, okay?
Okay.
The books or the movies. But I can't deny the cultural impact that series has had has been positive.
I would like to think so. I actually rather enjoyed the books.
I can't say that about Twilight. These things are horrible. Somebody, a fan told me the other day when we were bitching about this on Radiodrome, a fan told me the other day, Twilight is the most popular series of books written on a first grade level in the history of America.
Yeah,
and I'd
I
say
can.
Pretty much, because they're not, the prose is terrible, Scott.
I can't stand Stephanie Meyer's writing. I actually, seeing that this was a cultural phenomenon, I did pick up a copy of the first Twilight book.
I'm sorry.
I made it a chapter in.
See, I wouldn't have gone that
far. And I gave it away. I couldn't do it. But not only that, but let's get to the root of the story. You've got a choice between bestiality and necrophilia.
And
your vampire is a
pedophile.
Exactly. You know,
he's a 400-year-old banging teenagers.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, there's something inherently wrong in this.
Yes. And Twilight changed the very root of the vampire mythos and changed the very root of the werewolf mythos, the stuff that's been around for hundreds of years.
Not even that, Scott. It also changed the woman's lib movement. I keep hearing about how Bella is a strong character.
Oh, bullshit.
Now, Bella is a leech. She is a verbally and emotionally abusive
yep.
to multiple men. Yep. She plays mind games. There is no way she is a strong or positive character.
Yeah,
she has set back the woman's movement.
That and I mean, you know, she has no spine of her own.
And Christian Stewart can't act to save her
life. Oh, she can act. She can act. But she only has one expression
Gillian Anderson emoted more in 9 seasons of The X-Files than Kristen Stewart does in a 90-minute fucking movie. Okay.
Patrick Stewart emoted more in one episode of Star Trek TNG than Kristen,
Kristen Stewart, through the
entire series.
And we're recording this early, so this may have been debunked by the time this airs. She has just been offered the role of Kay in the new Akira remake, the American Akira remake, and it just made the internet go, God damn it! He has no response to that.
I think I just had a little bit of a stroke.
Yeah.
Look, I'm a fan of Akira. I like that movie.
And I've read all the original comics.
Why are they fucking with it?
Because now it's going to be set in New York.
Oh.
It's going to have a multicultural gang
because
you know, you can't have a racial gang anymore. All the characters are going to be Americanized. Their names are going to be Americanized.
Oh, then just call it something else.
They can't, because people would go, oh, this is just an American ripoff of Akira.
Well, exactly. That's what it is.
Pretty much.
That's what it is. Why? You know, you could just call it AKEERAH.
Blade Runner ripoff number 49.
Exactly. You know, why hide anymore? Why hide anymore?
Well, I know this isn't our topic, but it comes down to why remake something if you change every single thing about it?
Or why remake something when it doesn't need to be remade?
We've talked about this before.
We
remember
have.
When I showed you Videodrome?
Yes, yes, yes.
The new Videodrome remake is about nanites taking over the internet.
I know.
Does that have anything whatsoever to do with the original 1982 Videodrome?
No.
So, all right. We'll go back to fandom. It's just the Kristen Stewart thing pisses me off.
Anyway, fandom. Fandom ruined it, but there was at least I will give the Harry Potter series this. When it comes from transitioning from books into movies.
I've heard they're way different.
They are, but if you read, for instance, the last book is 700 and some pages.
Okay.
Okay, try and squeeze that into two-hour movies. Well, they should have been able to, but
I was going to say, it doesn't sound like it would have been that hard.
No, but before, some of the books that are considerably longer than one movie could be, and there's just a lot of stuff in the books that trying to get them into the movies, like internal monologues and stuff like that, it just doesn't work. They're two different mediums, and I think as far as Harry Potter goes, they did some pretty decent jobs transitioning from books into movies. You don't lose a whole lot, except for the fourth film, I believe.
I've only seen the first one, and the only reason was I worked at the theater at the time.
There's a couple of subplots that ended up not being subplots, but pretty major to the plot that ended up getting left out. And there are some changes, but really not bad overall.
But see, that happens a lot when you adapt a book. Let's just stick with books at this point. Let's leave comic books and things out for the sake of argument here. We'll just talk about, you know, novels, novellas, things like that.
I was going to say, at least with comic books, you've already got your story storyboarded.
Yeah, look at Sin City. They actually used, Robert Rodriguez used the comic books pages as his storyboards.
Yeah, 300 did the same thing.
Except 300 sucked.
300 was great. Go blow yourself.
If only if I could. I'm not that flexible. But when you adapt a book, like you said, they're two different mediums. Something that works on the page might not work in print.
Or it might be prohibitively expensive, or you might not have the actors that are able to do it.
Or there's the other thing of sometimes subplots in a book are fine. In a movie, they destroy the pacing, or they end up hurting the message. In the book,
they work, but can you give me an example of
Jaws?
I'm drawing a complete blank on a good example, but
Jaws.
I knew you'd have one.
In the book, there's this huge. Okay, remember in the movie how the mayor does not want to cancel, you know, close the beaches. He doesn't want to cancel summer and all that. Blah blah. In the book, there's a reason. He's in debt to the mob. The mob are trying to move in, and they own all the businesses that need to stay open. That's why there's this whole subplot with the mob threatening Brody. They end up killing his cat to send a message. And there's just, you know, chapters and chapters on his little internal battle with whether the mob is going to influence whether the shark closes the beaches.
Whereas
in the
I remember
book,
in
it
the,
works.
In the book, it works. In the movie, I remember he just kind of came across as
an asshole.
No, I need the money for my city. Screw you. We're keeping things open.
Right. And the mob stuff doesn't really detract that much in the book.
Right.
But you can see if they had put all that in the movie, not only the pacing would have been destroyed, but it just would have, and it also would have drug the running time out probably another 30, 35 minutes,
exactly.
Too. So there are sometimes, like, that's a good example. Another one is, have you ever seen Red Dragon?
Yes.
Have you seen Manhunter?
No.
Okay, Manhunter's the just brilliant Michael Mann adaptation of that same novel, okay?
Okay.
And it would be the first appearance of Hannibal Lecter, although Brian Cox plays him so much better than Anthony Hopkins does. Brian Cox plays the character totally differently. He plays them as this cold, emotionless, ultra manipulator.
Which really, if you read the books, that's what Hannibal Lecter was.
Right. His name was even spelled different in Manhunter originally. It was Lector. There was a K in there.
Oh, okay.
But the Brian Cox version is much better. Now, if you've seen Red Dragon, you know it's kind of a dopey movie with all the stuff about him eating the painting and the dumb ending with him faking his own death to get back at William Peters. William Peterson, that's the actor from Manhunter.
I know. You to get back at what's his face, the little baby face kid.
No, to get back at the investigator.
Yeah,
Will Graham.
Thank
is
you.
The character.
Thank you.
But Manhunter adapted that same novel, but Michael Mann made the decision. Okay. The eating the painting stuff, that's dumb. The huge back tattoo, that's dumb. The ending where he fakes his own death, that's dumb. And he changed all of that and basically took an okay novel and made it into a fucking brilliant movie.
See, now, to be fair, it's pretty good in the novel. It works out well in the novel somewhat.
Maybe the fact that I had already seen Manhunter before I read the novel... I was influenced. Maybe if I'd read the novel first, I don't know if I'd have a different opinion.
I'll tell you, in that series, Hannibal, just the very last one, not the prequel where it shows him young.
Hannibal Rising. Who gives a shit?
Not Hannibal Rising, but the very last one of Hannibal where he is in Italy and they're going through all of that. If you read the novel of that versus watch the movie.
I've heard the
totally different.
I've heard the novels rambling and
not
concise. That's what I've heard.
Not really. At least I got it on audiobook.
Okay.
And mind you, I got it on abridged audiobook.
Maybe that's why it's not rambling.
That's
maybe
why
they
it's
cut
not
out
rambling
all the rambling
so much.
Shit.
They must have cut it out. But I can actually loan you those CDs. But the ending is 180 degrees.
They actually shot three endings. There's a couple of alternate endings on the DVD.
I haven't seen it yet.
That ending's probably on the DVD.
But nonetheless, I like the novel a whole lot better than I like the movie. And I enjoyed the movie, don't get me wrong. But the novel is considerably better.
Well, and then you have other cases where not so much the novel, but the novelization when you're talking about a movie.
Star Wars.
I can name you a dozen different ones right now. You got to realize when the writer writes the novelization, he's working off.
Hang on just a moment. Oh, I feel better. Sorry.
And probably about 5 pounds lighter.
Yes.
Scott had
to
quick go drop a dookie, and you probably never even noticed that anything happened if we hadn't talked about
it. Well, I was doing the bathroom dance, and so I had to pause, and I couldn't.
Were you prairie dogging?
I was turtle heading.
Because, okay, and for anyone who doesn't know, you know how a prairie dog sticks his head out and then goes back in?
Yep.
Just imagine where we're going with this.
Or turtle head, same thing. Anyway, okay. You were talking about novelizations, and I apologize for interrupting.
Well, what usually happens is the author of the novelization ends up getting the script, and that's what they're working off of. Because you got to remember, the novelization hits the shelves the week the movie comes out. So there's obviously no way that they can see the finished product before they write their novelization.
Right.
In some cases, massive changes to the script will get done. And so you've got all these novelizations with tons of deleted scenes, with tons of subtext that get cut out of the final film. In a case like The Frighteners, they were working off a totally different script. Peter Jackson had decided he wanted to go in a different direction and rewrote the script after the novelization had been started. So the novelization is a completely different story, even though it's got the cover.
I might have to pick up that novelization and see what...
It's totally different. It's a lot darker, too.
Oh, I believe it.
You know, and then like... And sometimes you get little pieces of subtext that are not in the final film, such as Alien. If you read the novelization, not only do you get the famous cocoon deleted scene, which the novelization was showing us that scene years before anyone actually found the footage of it and was actually able to see it, but there's this little subtext that, you know, they're basically on this you know, space semi and whatnot, you know, these seven people and whatnot. There's this thing about how there was this casual sex between all of them, you know, to pass the time. You know, you're stuck with these people for months at a time. There's casual sex.
As you do.
Including homosexuality, because most of the crew was men. None of that even hinted at in the movie. So you get extra subtext in the novelization. Huh. And you're able to do stuff in novelizations that you can't do physically in the movie because of, well, certain physical things, such as aliens. Remember when the aliens cut the power? How could they cut the power, man? They're animals. Remember that? And then yes. It's all red lighting.
Right.
In the novelization, it's totally dark except for their shoulder flashlights. That's the only light you get.
Ooh.
That would raise the tension level a lot, but in a movie,
it would also
it's
look
really
like
erratic
crap.
And
yes.
look like shit.
Yes.
So, but it gives you a totally different feel when you're reading that scene in the novelization than when you're seeing it in the movie.
Hmm.
So in a lot of cases, you get deleted, just sometimes massively deleted scenes when you read the novelization.
Well, Star Wars, it reminds me of, it wasn't Luke and his little gang of friends on Tatooine, didn't that end up in the Star Wars novelization and never made it into the movie? Or
never made it into the movie. You know, the deleted scenes are out there. You can see all the deleted scenes. And it's funny. George Lucas didn't cut those scenes. The editor figured out that they destroyed the pacing and whatnot. Again, you know, George Lucas, great filmmaker, had to have the editor tell him, you do realize that this fucks the pacing totally up, right?
We're not here to harp on George Lucas. So.
Again. I'm sorry. Just I'm so sick of him being called this genius. Okay. I'm fine. I'm fine.
I rank him right up there with Quentin Tarantino. Love doing that to you. Hey, Josh. Retro.
You know, dead air is not good.
Yeah, I know. But
and that's all you're going to get if you keep this shit up.
Okay.
But so... Yeah, all those scenes are in the novelization, you know, and then not so much book to like movie in that, but look at all of the fandom stuff that comes out in novels of say, remember after, it's my cell phone.
Oh, okay.
You're hearing this buzz. I got my cell phone on vibrate in my jacket pocket.
What is that noise?
do you remember like? Before Star Trek the Motion Picture, when Star Trek Classic was just on TV and blowing up huge, there was just hundreds of different novels that came out that expanded the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the, and then you have this whole thing of like the asshole thing that Roddenberry set down, and George Lucas kind of did as well with the Star Wars universe was, didn't happen on screen, didn't happen. All those Star Trek novels you read, none of them actually happened.
They were all a dream.
You know, all those Star Trek novels you read didn't actually happen. Yeah. You know, unless they were personally overseen by me, didn't happen.
Okay. I mean, that I can almost understand because, especially in Star Wars, in Star Trek and Star Wars, both universes.
Universes?
Universes.
Okay. It's
plural of universe. Trying to keep track of all of that canon.
Then don't okay it. Like with Star Wars, Lucas had to okay everything. Then don't okay a Princess Leia story that goes in this direction if you know it technically is a fantasy story that didn't make it, that didn't have any real impact on the universe.
No, I can understand that though. I really can. Okay, neat little what if story. Do it. It's like alternate history stories, you know.
Marvel Comics had a great comic called What If? You know, what if Spider-Man or what if the Punisher killed Spider-Man? And it goes off, but and there was specifically that. But the Star Trek and Star Wars stuff never told you that. It was, oh, cool, Dr. McCoy is having this really cool, you know, character arc. And then the next novel comes out and you go, where's that character? And you go, oh, that didn't happen yet. You know, that didn't happen. And then, well, what about in the movie? Oh, those nine books, those didn't happen. And,
okay.
You know,
no,
to me, that's bullshit.
To me, I think that's okay. I mean, you know, hell, if you can reset an entire comic series and just blow out everything that's happened.
Another shot at DC not? There.
Yeah, and Marvel too. fuck you, comics. I'm never reading again. And I realize I lost some fans when I said I'm never buying another DC comic. And I don't care. I really don't.
Because new DC sucks.
Yeah, it does.
But
anyway, I can understand that because, yeah, it would be nice if you would put down the what if. But, you know, to me, all of that expanded universe stuff, whether it's Star Wars, Star Trek, what else did
Firefly.
I say? Firefly, stuff like that. I know it's expanded universe. I know that it may have been okayed, but it's not probably not going to show up in the mainstream continuity.
Continuity, it means something. To me, continuity is something that you should be very cognizant of.
And I think it would be nice. I don't see it happening. Again, especially in universities as big as Star Trek and Star Wars, trying to keep track of what every author has done, not to mention the animated series and the comic books that were out and the picture, like the movie picture books that were out that included stuff of deleted scenes and things like that.
Star Trek. This is one thing that was really irritating. And I know I'm not going to turn this into an all Star Wars bitch. Do you remember the Star Wars comic strip?
No.
The daily and then Sunday comic strip?
Nope.
It came out after Star Wars, right before Empire. And they had all these really cool things of Vader and Han Solo and that. And then Empire came out and they said, oh, okay, now we're going to take the continuity of Empire. So the last 2 years worth of reading the comic strips didn't matter anymore. Now the comic strips are picking up with Empire's continuity.
Okay.
And then they would do that for a couple of years. Then Jedi would come out and then, now those don't make any difference. Now we're taking Jedi's continuity.
Okay.
Star Trek did the same thing with their daily comic strip and their weekly comic strip.
Okay.
And that's really irritating. It is continuity. No, it's not. Not anymore. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Not anymore.
Irritating, but they're right.
No, they're not.
No. Not they are correct, right? It is their right to do such a thing.
It's a stupid thing, though.
Okay, but it is still their right to do it.
Okay, I'll give you that, but it's still stupid.
Okay.
But then...
gripe all you want. You may as well go pound your head against a brick wall.
You don't have any brick. Your walls are too thin.
You're right.
I'll probably put a hole in the wall.
The neighbor's house is brick. Feel free.
But then you also, when you get to like novels and that, you always hear this thing, you see the movie and you go, oh, well, the book was better. Sorry, guys. Not always.
Not always. To me, there are varying degrees. There is, oh, my God, the book was so much better. If they ever make a movie of American Gods... or Good Omens,
the two books by
Neil Gaiman. There, Gaiman is probably one of my favorite authors in the world. No movie they make can live up to my expectations or live up to my imagination. I know that. I know I'm going to go to the movie and be like, "Oh my God, the books were so much better." That's one level. Then you have the Harry Potter, where you go and you're like, "Okay, I enjoyed these books. They were pretty good." And you go to the movie and you go, wow, now I can see all of that stuff and I kind of have voices to hear in my head when I go. And it was a pretty good adaptation. Wasn't perfect, wasn't page for page, but it was pretty darn good. Hooray. And then you have those where the movie, and I'll again leave this for an example for you, where the movie ends up considerably better than the book.
Right, like Manhunter was.
Like Manhunter was for, or Jaws, really, I think.
Yeah, Jaws is a far better movie than the book was.
Exactly.
Well, and then you have some that, now, because William Peter Blatty has basically confirmed Gramercy does not have any of this footage anymore. We're probably never going to actually see William Peter Blatty's version of Exorcist 3.
Okay.
And first of all, Exorcist 3, highly underrated movie. Okay, ignore that 3 in the title. Exorcist 3 is a phenomenal film until the last 10 minutes, but that's not Blatty's fault. The studio made him change it.
Was this the one with the flashy lights?
No, that was 2.
Okay.
Exorcist 3 is the one with George C. Scott and...
Okay. Because I had 2 in my head with that god-awful... psychological hospital 1970s screamy place and the flashy lights and
James Earl Jones dressed as a giant grasshopper. That's 2.
I was about to punch you in the face.
No, 3 is a brilliant film, and okay. Blatty just gorgeously directs it, and Gramercy destroyed this movie in post. Having read the novel it's based on, Legion, which is it's an actual sequel to the Exorcist novel, okay?
Okay.
So there are scenes in Exorcist 3 that are word for word, shot for shot, like they are written in the book.
Yes.
Except I never noticed this till I read the novel. you can see exactly where little edits are made. Like this, people will start to open their mouth in the movie, and then I'll go, in the book, there was an extra sentence there.
Ah.
And stuff like that. And you can see exactly, okay, they cut like 30 seconds out of this scene. And that is really annoying once you've read the book, and the book is so far superior. And you kind of got to wonder, the movie looked like it was sticking pretty close. Because, I mean, Blatty wrote and directed the adaptation of his own novel.
Sure,
so
sure.
He pretty much was being faithful to it. When you get something like that, when you're reading the book, just really enhances the quality of the movie, because in a way, now you're able to see the scenes that aren't there. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, again, going back to the Harry Potter, because I read the whole freaking series of books before I saw the movies and everything. Seven books, okay. Eight movies. Well, seven movies.
I know, I know.
Part one, part two, which is an annoying trend that I'm seeing toward Hollywood, and that's another
topic
altogether.
Annoying trends in Hollywood. That's actually a good future topic.
Yeah, we may do that. There, for instance, there were a couple of, like I said, the fourth, fifth movie, somewhere in the middle there, where entire subplots and entire ideas and reasons were kind of left out. There's one where he gets the map that shows where everybody is.
I haven't read these.
I understand. No. But there's one where he gets a map of that shows where everybody is, basically. It tracks not only a certain place, but all of the people that are there, and shows. It's called the Marauder's Map. Anyway,
okay.
There's an entire subplot about that map that ends up being integral to Harry's overall story that is left out. There is an entire subplot that would have brought him much closer to his teacher, which if you go to movies in the future, he ends up being one of his teachers is a werewolf, Remus. And he ends up being very, very close to this teacher. And in the movies, you're kind of like, where the hell did that relationship come from? In the books, you learn why.
Well, I haven't read these. You may have. Have you read the Lord of the Rings books?
Oh, yeah.
Because everyone keeps telling me the only one of the Tolkien's books I've read is The Hobbit, which doesn't have this character as far as I remember, was Tom Bombadil. Everybody says, well, he's so, you know, he's pretty important, but he's not important. And, you know, he's never in any of the movies. I actually think the Ralph Bakshi one, I think he's mentioned.
I think he's mentioned or he makes a very brief appearance.
Yeah, but he's got really nothing to do. But everyone says, like, Tom Bombadil, for some reason, he's cut out of every adaptation. Even the audio, when they had audio plays in the late 70s and early 80s, he was cut out of that. And it's like, why is the character so important in the book, yet somehow is not missed in the visual and audio translations of that?
Because, and I'm going to make people angry here, Tom Bombadil and his Forest of Faggotry is not...
Forest of Faggotry, really?
Yes, trust me. Oh man, trust me. There's, I will loan you the books because, but nonetheless, Tom Bombadil, while he's a good character and he's a fun character in the books, and I can see why people would think that he would play an important part. The truth is, you can cut him out, and tell the story in different ways, much like Peter Jackson did, or Bakshi did, or everybody who's made an adaptation has. You can tell a story in a different way and end up with the same information being conveyed in a much more efficient manner. And when you're talking about movies and audiobooks and audio plays and radio plays and all that kind of stuff, efficiency matters.
Pacing is not as important in a book than it is in a visual medium.
For instance, if you adapted a Faulkner novel, or if you truly adapted every word that Tolkien wrote, Tolkien went into the inner monologues and the inner thoughts and described in such immaculate detail.
Frank Herbert did the same thing with Dune.
Yeah, you'll end up with, you know, 2 pages of action and 15 to 20 pages of description. Because he had a very clear idea of this. And if you truly adapted, let's say you did a voiceover a la Blade Runner or something like that, or Dune, the movie.
The inner thought monologue.
Yes, the inner thought monologues. If you really went into those with Tolkien, even for just, you know, the Fellowship of the Ring, the very first Lord of the Rings deal, you would end up with a 22-hour movie, which some people might be going, yeah, but to tell you the truth,
no.
These extended cuts that I've got on DVD, that, you know, the 2-3 DVD sets, it's about as long as I can take.
Well, okay, speaking of that, now, I loaned you Watchmen the comic, did I not?
Yes, you did.
And you watched the movie.
Yes, I have.
Now, I know we said we're going to leave comics out of this, but this one is a big deal when right. It comes to this. The ending. Which ending did you prefer?
I prefer the movie ending.
Me too. It's more realistic. It fits more into the universe
yep.
that they're doing. And it doesn't come so far out of left field as a giant space octopus.
Exactly.
And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but that's basically what it is. It's a giant space octopus.
Right. And
in the comic.
The movie ending... It seemed more
realistic. It's arguably
realistic. It's arguably more realistically and darker, and you kind of get a little bit more of an insight to these characters, to the evil side of these characters. And I can never pronounce his name.
Which character?
Rorschach? Oh, no, not Rorschach.
Ozymandias?
Thank you. Yeah. You
just get, call him Ozzy.
Yeah, you get more... I think Ozzy ends up looking even darker in the movie than he did in the comic.
Yeah, and the way I look at it, that change was necessary. And even Alan Moore, who wrote the comic, was not happy with the ending.
Right.
So, to me, it was not a slap in the face for Zack Snyder and his writing team to go, let's tweak this a little bit. You know, even Alan Moore wasn't happy with this thing.
Right.
You know, so I like that. I mean, now, if somehow Rorschach had lived... That would have pissed me off, because Rorschach has to die in both the comic and the movie
yeah.
for that story to work.
Exactly.
If Rorschach had lived, you know, because the studio wanted sequel bait or something, then I would have been mad.
Exactly.
That would have been a change I would not have sat and accepted.
Have there been any, and I, you know me in following comics, have there been any Watchmen sequels?
Sequels, no, but there was the role-playing game which gave a lot of extra stuff to the characters. In Rorschach's case, it was all stuff that happened before,
right.
You know, when he was a rogue. But the role-playing game, which, by the way, to find those original books, those go for a shit ton of money.
I have no doubt. But I would like to see...
But yeah, Watchmen, yeah. That's something Alan Moore fought against the whole time. Because he was always against the commercialization of it. He didn't even like when the book was coming out, DC was giving away little free promo buttons with, you know, characters on
right.
it and stuff. And, you know, you're commercializing this. Well, they're a commercial entity. What did you think that DC
exactly.
was going to do with it?
Exactly.
But so there's Watchmen. And then there are other adaptations that just have you scratching your head where you go, okay, I've read the book. I've seen the movie. Other than the fact that the characters have the same name, these are two totally different things. What? How do you call this an adaptation?
Exactly.
I've seen that so many times where there are times I see a movie and I don't even know until reading the credits, and I go, "This was based on a book," and then I look up the book and I go, "That's got a totally like." Here's one for you. Now, keep in mind, this movie isn't even done being made yet. It's a book you loved. The author, Max Brooks, is making World War Z. And the plot has got nothing whatsoever to do with the book.
Yeah.
So how is it in... Because everyone knows what the book is about. You know, the reporter getting all the different stories about the world, you know, about the zombie outbreak
right,
and whatnot.
Right.
The movie is about... someone that works for the United Nations following the zombie outbreak and trying to stop it from spreading worldwide.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's just a zombie movie.
Yeah.
And this is the author himself doing it. Why? Then why are you even making it World War Z? Why don't you just say, I want to make a zombie movie?
Can I be honest? I'm about zombied out.
Well, I realize that, but I'm just saying, I'm using that as an example that, now obviously we haven't seen the film.
Right.
But the plot that they've released on their website has got zero in common with the book other than the fact that they both have zombies in it.
Right. And I enjoyed that book. It was very good. It's one of those, actually, speaking of things that are better than the page.
You've mentioned the audio.
The audio, yeah, the audio book of World War Z is even better than the written book of World War Z.
But you have that sometimes where you just the author.
And by the way, the reason why I do so many audiobooks, just to let our audience know, because they might be thinking, can Scott read? No, I'm not lazy. I'm dyslexic. So
it's just it's easier, and yeah. I've never made fun of him.
I get 4 or 5 pages of print done, and I have to put down the book for a little while. Which, Good Omens and American Gods, American Gods took me 10 and a half months to read, to give you an idea, and it's not a long book, so that's why I do so many audiobooks. It's my just dyslexia easier. Just gets a whole really bad, so I can close my eyes and enjoy the story. So
well. And then you also have the whole thing about there are certain authors that you just wonder, why do they, I mean, obviously, you know, like the one I'm going to bring up, he's dead, so it's his estate wanting money.
Right.
And that's Philip K. Dick. Why is no one able to adapt one of his books faithfully? Why buy the title and then say, we want to change everything?
Yeah, I don't
know. All they want is the title. And I'm so sick of that. Because, like, the new Total Recall remake, and it's they keep saying it's not a remake because, look, I've read We Can Remember It for Your Wholesale, right, in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Right.
The barest plot is all that they have in common. And some scanner, of the characters' names.
A Scanner Darkly.
Right, I mean, Blade Runner.
In there, Blade Runner.
Well, Blade Runner, I can, having read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, I can see they're similar enough that I can call that an adaptation. It's just changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
Whereas, I can see in my head, having seen Blade Runner, when I read the book, I can see the images from Blade Runner actually laying over the descriptions and working.
Whereas
the new Total Recall, they said, "Well, we're going to adapt we're going to stick closer to the original story." Guys, you realize the original story is only like 16 pages long, right?
Right.
And has an ending that is going to alienate most of your audience if you go with the story's ending.
Well, the other one that I saw that in another sci-fi film was Kubrick/Spielberg's film AI.
Ugh, that. Oh my, what a pretentious piece of shit.
Yes.
Could that ending have gone on longer?
I know. And that's, frankly, I think that a lot of people go, well, that movie sucked because Spielberg got a hold of it and Kubrick passed away. No. Look at 2001, A Space Odyssey. Look at
boring plotting.
You know, for some reason, when it comes to endings, Kubrick failed.
2001, perfect example.
Yeah, to 2001, that ending of that whole deal, just the pacing of the whole movie just halts and drags on and on. Hello, Adelaide. My cat. What was the other? Well, AI. AI was another one where the ending just drug on and on.
Have you ever read the original story that 2001 is based on, The Sentinel? Other than a couple of little plot points, nothing whatsoever. And talk about ruining the story. And the story wasn't even that great to begin with.
I believe it.
But 2001, even Arthur C. Clarke, the author of the book, well, novella, really. It's not long enough to be a novel, but of the novella, said Kubrick added so much pointless, you know, all those 15 minutes of floating in space to classical music. He said if he'd actually adapted the book, the movie would have been 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
And the movie's 2 hours and 17 minutes long.
Yeah.
And you go, Jesus, the whole movie's padding. Talk about pretentious bullshit. And, you know, I know as a science fiction fan, I'm going to come across weird railing against that, but 2010, much, much better movie.
2010 was really good.
And I'm speaking of that, also changed massively.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
all that Russian-American conflict in the movie?
Right.
None of that's
in
the book.
None of that's in the book. I'm actually really curious. Do they have plans to do 2063 or?
They've been talking. Sometimes it's 2063. Sometimes it's 3001.
Yeah.
That's been off and on for a decade now. Hey, it's on. We got funding. Oh, wait, the script fell through. We need to redo this. Hey, we got. Oh, no, we didn't.
But I really enjoyed 2010, and I realized that that whole Russian-American.
That was a very tension, 1984 thing.
That was a very much of the time thing that
but honestly
came out. But it was
the movie's still a lot better than the book. 2010 goes into a lot of. I don't normally use this word in this negative way, but it goes into a lot of fanciful directions that a hard science story should not have gone into.
Okay.
You know, I mean, he pretty much decided screw science by the middle of that book. and he just wanted to tell, you know, what was a fun story rather than anything else. And it was like the novel really is more like a 50s sci-fi, you know, pulp novel.
Huh.
The movie is way, way better than the book. Maybe I'm in the minority. If people have issues with that, lostinthestaticshow@gmail.com, maybe I'm in the minority if you've read the book and seen the movie, but I really didn't like the book. Maybe it's, again, because I saw the movie first.
Yeah.
Maybe if I'd read the book first, I'd hate the movie. I don't know.
I actually, that one, I haven't met too many people that, you know, they say the movie is the movie and it's very good for the movie and the book is the book and it's okay for the book. And they draw the very... And I'm one of those people. I draw this very distinct line between the book and the movie, and people can always come up and go, well, the book was considerably better. And I go, well, yes, it was the book, and it was a very good book. But the movie, take it for what it is, it's pretty good.
But see, I remember when I was growing up, it was always this thing. The book's better than the movie. And I say even back when we were growing up, that wasn't true.
The book was not always better than the movie. Watership Down. I've not read the book, unfortunately. Very, very good movie. Very, very good book. Two very distinct things. Draw a line. The only, you know, they share some characters. They share some storyline. They share a title.
Well, and sometimes the book helps you enjoy the movie, such as the brilliant 1984 adaptation of 1984. The one with John Hurt
and Richard Burton. If you read the book first.
But there is a lot of stuff that I'd read the book before I saw the movie.
Right.
If I had just, a friend of mine was watching the movie with me, and he had not read the book, and there were all these things I had to keep explaining to him. The movie kind of assumes
that you've read the book.
Because there's all these things they don't explain that you kind of go, wait a minute,
Yeah.
But make total sense when you've read the book. You go, okay, because see, that happens because of this, and this person had done this, you know, in a previous thing that's in a deleted scene. And, you know, to me, the book enhances the movie, and the movie enhances the book.
In fact, I can tell you back in high school, in an English lit class, we did just that. We watched 1984, the movie.
The 1984 version?
The 1984 version.
Because there was also a 1956 black and white version.
Yeah, this was not the black and white one. This was the 1984 version. We watched that, and my teacher was Christine Ney, and God bless her. We watched the movie, and we were like, okay. And then we read the book, and then we watched the movie again.
And it makes so much more sense.
Huge difference. So, yeah, there are also those where the movie can be an enhancement to the book or vice versa.
Or sometimes you have that weird ground where you'll have a book that'll come out, be really popular, and they don't adapt it, but they make a movie that's basically a sequel to it. And so somehow the movie has required you to have read the book.
I don't remember. Give me an example.
Well, not so much a sequel. We were talking about Akira earlier.
Right.
Something like that. If you've never read the comics.
Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
The movie doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Exactly.
You know, you really, really needed to have read those comics to follow the story.
That's very true. In fact, I remember the first time I saw Akira, I thought, boy, this looks beautiful, but...
Makes no sense at all.
Why does he keep screaming, Tetsuo? What's going on? I don't know. And then I read the books, and I was like, aha.
Makes sense now.
Ta-da!
Well, and then there's also ones, and this is not a good movie, but like the Stallone Judge Dredd movie. Okay? Visually, it's a perfect adaptation.
It's very pretty. Yeah.
No, I mean, the costumes look exactly like they do in the comic.
Yeah.
The weapons, the way they, you know, the speech patterns, the words they use,
right.
The vehicles, the city. Problem is, the script doesn't match.
Not at all.
But they got everything right on a visual level. That is what a Judge Dredd movie should have looked like.
Yes, if you mute that and just watch the visuals, it is very pretty.
And it, you know, it'll kill Rob Schneider, but you know, Judge Dredd doesn't need a comic release. He already has that with his kind of gay, neurotic android housekeeper in the comics.
Which wasn't in the movie, which was really weird.
Right. Well, and then you also have other things. Like in the comics, you've never in like 7,000 stories, never. I mean, the few times his helmet comes off, they have a foreground object blocking it, or it's seen through,
or it's
like
seen from the back, or
yeah, or yeah, things like that. And guys, go back and read the first 3 or 4 stories. He was black in the original, in the first couple of stories.
No,
Dredd was African American.
No,
Dredd was black in the first couple. He only became white due to a coloring error. I'm not joking. He only became white due to a coloring error.
Okay.
Otherwise, he was supposed to be an African American character. And somehow they found out he got more popular once they whitened him. I guess that says something about race relations in England at the time.
I don't know.
But you know, you got a movie like Judge Dredd. Hopefully the new movie will have that same visual appeal while sticking true to the source material this time.
I doubt it.
It's supposed to.
I'm sorry. I'm losing.
Carl Urbane has outright said, you know, he plays Dredd in this one. He was Dr. McCoy in the Star Trek remake.
Right.
Dredd never takes his helmet off.
Right.
That's at least something right there.
That's something.
Dredd never takes his helmet off.
But to tell you the truth, when it comes to comic book movies, I'm kind of losing faith. Spider-Man 3 kind of
all hurt. All the Spider-Mans. Yeah. I hated all of them. And I don't know what Sam Raimi was thinking. I can't see how the Sam Raimi I grew up watching made those fucking pieces of shit.
I don't know. It hurt. It hurt.
Those films were terrible.
And the return of Superman... I mean, to me, nobody can be Superman but Chris Reeve. It's just you can't go back and see how he played that character.
So then do you discount George Reeves from the 40s?
No, because I think those are different characters. I mean, movie-wise, because George Reeves, he did the serial thing. And
the TV series.
And the TV series, and that's one kind of Superman, and he kind of plays that well. And then you have Chris Reeves, who steps in and really played that character, method acting. In fact, the guy that played Jimmy Olsen was recently interviewed, and he said, you know, anytime they were on set, he was referred to as Jimmy, and he was to call Chris Superman, and that was just how Chris, that or Clark, and that was just how Chris did his job. And he played that so method, and he played it so beautifully that I think any actor that steps into that role has such huge shoes to fill, I don't think he can.
Well, and Brandon Routh just wasn't that good of an actor to
begin
with. And I'm sorry, this new Zack Snyder version, it just looks horrible.
I don't know. I haven't seen much about it. But, yeah, you know.
Russell Crowe is his dad.
Oh, God. Jesus.
Yeah. Russell Crowe is Jor-El. I mean, Marlon Brando? Maybe not have been perfect casting.
But he worked.
Yeah, he did the job he was supposed to do.
Exactly.
Well, that's something else. In the last minute and a half, we got when you hire the wrong person to write a movie. Like, do you know who wrote the original script for the Superman movie from the 70s?
Who?
Mario Puzo, the guy that wrote the Godfather novel.
Really?
They hired him to write the first script.
Really?
How do you think Mario Puzo is going to make a Superman movie? Why you would even think that?
But you know, it'd be worth a shot.
But his script is supposedly terrible.
Okay,
his script is supposedly just like he did not get Superman at all.
Haven't read it. Don't know.
I haven't read that one either. That's why I say supposedly. But we gotta go. We want to say next week we're going to talk Christmas, sort of, and we want to say AdamandEve.com static. Use the codes. I mean, come on, get people something for Christmas, you know, get people something to stuff in themselves. You know, you talk about stocking stuffers, Well, get something so they can stuff their stockings.
I was going to say they sell both stockings and stuffers, so you're good.
Yeah, thanks. So, all right, good night.
Thanks a lot for joining us, everybody, and we will see you next week.
Night.